This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 13. This week, we took a look at Shanita's police interview. We heard about a trip to look for the murder weapon, as well as Terrell's arrest. While this episode filled in some gaps, it also raised some questions. And today, I'm joined by Bob and Janet to discuss all of these things. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
Yeah, housekeeping schedule thing we got coming up. So just to give you guys a heads up, there is not going to be a main episode or a follow-up this week. So there won't be a main episode Sunday. We're taking a week off. And it's just scheduling issue. Erica's got some things with her college and her other scheduling where she can't get into edit. I've got a bunch of things that I've got going on this week with my kid. And it was just kind of a game day decision right before we got on the stream here today that we're just trying to figure out how we could work all this out and with Zach and Janet and everybody and decided we're just going to take this week off. Let us regroup and catch up. So we'll have the week off probably. Couple things, though. There may be an episode on Sunday. So I just literally an hour before we started recording tonight, a witness from one of our previous cases somehow found the show, found us and our website and reached out to me and said they'd like to talk to me. And so I'm trying to make arrangements with them to come on and do an interview. So if that happens, it'll be, it won't be, a perfectly edited masterpiece like Erica usually puts together, but we'll just, if I can get the interview done, we'll probably put that out as a bonus on Sunday. Otherwise, there won't be anything this Sunday. So our next episode after this one will be next Sunday, which I think is the, let's say, 18th, perhaps the 19th. The 19th. It's the 19th. Yep. So that'll be the next episode coming out there. But for all you patrons, what we are going to do next week is Zach, Janet, and I are going to do just a pregame hour for you guys. So there won't, for those of you that aren't patrons, don't worry about it. It's not, we don't, in those pregame shows, we don't discuss the case or anything like that. It's literally just an hour of us doing a live stream with the patrons where we just kind of shoot the shit and just talk about our lives and things like that. But so we will be doing that next week, probably Wednesday, but there won't be any normal episode next week. So just wanted to let everyone know about that and make sure you check your feed. Of course, I'll put it out on social media also if I do get that interview to put out on Sunday. Otherwise, after this episode, we'll talk to you guys next Sunday. And with that, I don't think there's any other major housekeeping going. We've got some stuff going on with some of our previous cases right now, but nothing I can share right now. But I'll say there's some good things happening that hopefully we'll have some good breaking news for a couple of our previous seasons coming up soon. Now, back to this one. This episode was kind of a weird one to write because, like I mentioned, it was just kind of filling in some gaps to try to figure out exactly how all this transpired. I personally feel like now I have a real good idea of the timeline and how things happened. So first things first, I know we don't have a whole lot of listener questions, but what did you guys think of the episode? And particularly what I decided to call the title of the episode, Chris's words when he was asked by the attorney, Mr. Ruff, weirdly, in the transcript, if those cops just decided they would let somebody get away with murder.
JV, if you want to go first.
I liked it. I mean, yeah, I was, because I definitely didn't know where it was going. It was definitely a title. I feel like it's rare that there's a title where I really am just like, why is it called They Did? Like, where I'm sort of wondering where the punctuation is. Like what is They Did question mark? Is it an exclamation mark? Is it a period? And yeah, it was, it's hard. Every time we get to this point in a case, and it seems like it's very often because of the nature of what you do, in some ways it's the hardest part. Like, in the same way that it's very difficult for me to watch, I mean, not in the same way, but certainly I'm sure this is relatable to other people, in the way where, like, sometimes I can't watch a movie where the one main character knows the truth and everyone else thinks that character is crazy, or everyone else is, you know, it's just a race against time because the person you care about the most is being done wrong left and right. And it's just so anxiety inducing. And hearing stories about asking for a lawyer and then being told it's not going to work that way is so scary. And it's also, it just feels like the worst of being a person in authority. It feels like it's the worst of the abuse of power. Like, do you know what I mean? I mean, it feels like the South in the, you know what I'm saying? Feeling, that idea of like, oh, I'm afraid it's not going to work that way. Like, no offense to the people who have Southern accents, but you know what I'm saying. It's like going back to this place of, you belong to me right now in this moment, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that is one of the most unpleasant, upsetting, and scary things to think about, to hear about, to know about. And it's very, very distressing to imagine that scenario. And I feel that anxiety, and I felt it the entire episode.
Yeah. And I forgot that you weren't here last week to talk about the, you know, Chris's interview where we went through that stuff. But yeah, it's like I said in the episode, I said in the follow up last week, like, that was terrifying to me, just kind of putting myself in those shoes. Like, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you do when you just, when you do the thing you're supposed to do? I want a lawyer. And they're like, nope.
Yeah.
You're just going to keep sitting here, and we're going to put your wife in prison, and we're going to send your kid to foster care if you don't do something, if you don't do what I want you to do. Well, I want a lawyer. Nope.
And you know that happens. Like, I'm sure there are many people who've walked through life who do hear us, you know, express that dismay and are just like, oh, you guys don't know any, like, you have no idea. Because you know there are bad actors out there where it's just like, that's a day's work, you know?
And especially when you were in an environment, you know, back, it shouldn't have been back then, but where, you know, a lot of these departments didn't have policies to where they have to record everything. It just opens so many doors for that kind of corruption. What do you think about this one, Zach?
Well, I think truly it shows a pattern of behavior for these detectives. You know, it shows that they will go, you know, above and beyond to get the answers they want. With Shanita, we see the same thing, the same pattern with Chris, the fact that she was held for a long time. We do have a few timestamps, as you said in this episode, you know, for a 5-page statement that do not correlate.
Yeah.
Same thing with Chris. So you're starting to see this pattern of behavior from these detectives that shows this is the way they operate. Mm-hmm. And who knows how many other cases they have operated like this and continued to push and push and push and just drawn out these long interviews to really try to break people.
Well, what I find so weird about it is it's such a sleight of hand. So, like, in that, you guys heard when I read Shanita's transcript, like, they put in like ums and you know, slang and thing that makes it look like you're reading a transcript that someone actually said. And I think that's by design. But then you, like, again, look at those timestamps and it's like, well, this couldn't have been all that was said in over an hour.
Right.
But then why do we have exact words, even down to the ums in the transcript and the stutters and everything like that is written in the transcript? It's kind of like you said, a pattern emerging, but it's like, they're practiced at this.
Right.
This isn't the first time that they did this.
Well, MO.
And when I say pattern emerging, it's not for them. It's for us to see the pattern.
Yeah.
Like, clearly it's something they do, but it's very easy for us to now start to diagnose and see this pattern of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. And it was cool for me too, when I went through too, to, you know, because everything, it's always tough, any case where there's been a lot of people working on it, you know, people tell you things about the case and you know, their opinions on it and how things have just kind of, you know, warped over the years. So things like, well, Shanita said she was there for hours and hours and hours in the police station. And then you're, and so it's always, you know, I always present that like, well, that's what they're saying happened, but I don't have proof. You know, I always want proof. I want evidence of that. And then it's like, to be able to confirm things like that, where it's like, okay, well, she was arrested at 11:30. She didn't finish the interview until, what did I say, like 4:54, 5:55, something like that. And then she was there at, it's like, yeah, everything they said happened. And that makes it even more. So it's like, when they're also saying, by the way, they wouldn't let me have an, you know, when Chris is saying they wouldn't let me have an attorney and they did all these things, it's like, well, so far, everything you've said that is provable has been proven true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, and it's hard. And I do have a couple questions that didn't come up that I think we can talk about really quick.
Sure.
In the episode, when we talk about like the Miller Beach search for the gun,
mm-hmm.
they never really clarify. They say the next morning. Do we know when that happened?
I couldn't get a solid, like there's no report
mm-hmm.
that I've seen like for what happened. It's just like, you got Donald's trial testimony where he vaguely mentions it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got Chris saying that it went out, but I wasn't able to really pin down exactly. It seemed like it was the next morning, but I'm not positive about that.
And that's what's hard is because mm-hmm. it says the next day, it says in the morning,
mm-hmm.
but what is that following? You know, is that?
Right, because there's also some confusion in that bit of transcript on, because he kind of goes back and forth between the first interview and the second interview. My understanding is, and logic would say it was after the second interview, because in the first interview, he didn't have a gun.
Right.
And so there was no way that they would have been, I'm going to go do it. So it had to have been after that second interview
mm-hmm.
on Sunday. But also that story is wild. I'm glad you brought it up because I don't think there were questions about it or comments about it. But like what the fact that even made it into trial, that he let him out to go look for the gun
mm-hmm.
without the jury hearing. Yeah, he said that he threw it out in the lake at Miller Beach, and then they drive out to the lake at Miller Beach, and there's pure driven snow. You know, it's obviously it had been a little warmer, it had melted, but you know, there's still snow on the ground. You can see there's not a single footprint anywhere near the lake, and there's an ice shelf that goes way out.
And I don't think people probably understand that ice shelf as well as like we do because we live here.
On Lake Michigan.
We live here on Lake Michigan, on the same exact lake that this is occurring. That ice shelf, the one that's directly by us, is can be 200 yards deep before you can get to liquid water.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's no way you're throwing anything.
And you're not walking on it. There's no way you're walking on it.
Right. And everybody around here is taught not to walk on it because it's extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there is definitely, I mean, the fact that there is no tracks from the beach to the water line, let alone that ice shelf that bounds up and it stays for a long time regardless of the temperature.
Yeah.
Because the temperature of the lake, it'll be there for months after the snow is gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, it's a very interesting thing to come upon.
That's why you put your arm around someone and say, listen, you and I both know there ain't going to be a gun out here.
Yeah. Just send him somewhere.
Like,
and it just shows like the idiocy of, but then also like almost the arrogance. Like again, this is all presuming that what Chris is telling us is true. Right. Because
mm-hmm.
we have to acknowledge that we can't prove that these things happened. This is just what Chris says happened. But the arrogance of that, if it happened the way Chris said it did, like we know they're not going to be gone out there. Just take them somewhere. They're going to go look. As someone who used to be on the dive rescue team, I know that like even if he had thrown a gun in there and it was like it's so hard to find something in search. And in Lake Michigan, with the way the tide moves the sand around, mm-hmm. like there's in a training one time when I was the fire chief and a dive rescue training, we lost a dummy, a 175 pound dummy that we had. So like we went out into like 40 feet of water and to do a training, we like dropped the dummy down and there was supposed to be a buoy on it so we could mark it for later. And then we went down to do search pads. So we knew where it was at and it's just a nothing but sand bottom. And then we went down to go find it. We had like marked it on the GPS, dropped the dummy. And the buoy never came up. Turns out the feller that hooked the buoy to the dummy, it had a big, he decided that the little plastic clip that came on the buoy wasn't strong enough. So he replaced it with a brass clip.
Oh no.
So imagine a string with a float on the end of it, but he had a brass clip on it.
So useless.
Useless. It sunk to the bottom. Mm-hmm. But then we're like, well, I mean, this is our job, right? We're dive rescue.
Right.
We spent hours. I went through like 2-3 tanks apiece trying to find, could not find the thing, marked it on the GPS. And then like 2 days later, went back out with a boat that had like side imaging sonar. So like you can for sure see it.
Yeah.
Gone. It was just like the sand had just moved over the top. And this is like a human sized dummy.
Yeah.
Sand had just moved over it to where it was just gone. That was it.
Wow.
So So just to clarify, because you kind of said it there, but I want to make sure. So there's no reports of this search.
Not that I've seen through the files. Okay. It, you know, and I worked through, and Erica's indexed everything and read through them and summarized everything. I scanned through to look for, because a lot of the stuff I keep like, okay, where's some more documentation about this? And it just doesn't exist in the police file. But kind of like what I was getting at is the arrogance of him just saying, I'll just go look for it. Like, that's someone who knows it's not going to matter. Mm-hmm. You know, we know we're not going to find anything. And then to go out there and realize not only are we not going to find a gun, but it is impossible for him to have thrown it. There's just something there that in my mind says, how arrogant do you have to be like, it doesn't matter, we'll spin this in court. He led us on a wild goose chase.
Right.
Certainly it wasn't that he didn't have a fucking clue where the gun's at.
Yeah.
But twist we do know it happened because he acknowledges it in court.
Yeah, we do know the trip out there happened.
Right.
But it's kind of put out there. We're going to get into all that in the next episode, what Donald said in court. But yeah, it's kind of put out there as like, yeah, and then he, you know, said he'd take us the gun, but couldn't find it. That was it.
And I know that I don't know much about this. It just seems like there would have to be some sort of report based on the fact that you had to take this incarcerated person out. You know, I mean, there's got to be some paperwork there.
Yeah.
On top of all the officers that went, you know, I mean, he lists a list of officers that went.
All of whom, by the way, could have been doing something else for a city that is taxed with a high crime rate and a high murder rate.
Like maybe investigating this murder would have been a good start.
Right? Like, don't tell me that you don't have the funds or the man hours for it when if this is true, you're spending this much time and energy and manpower.
And assembling the dive rescue team, which is no small feat.
And it's like, expensive. That's our taxpayers' money. Like, what?
Yeah, it's absolutely completely insane. And the way they just were able to take every little thing and just spin it in their favor in front of the jury is Olivia in our live chat just said, seeing as how hard it is to for cases to be overturned on appeal just makes things like this even harder to stomach.
Absolutely, and that's, like, Olivia.
Yeah, it's like when you cut corners and cheat and lie to get someone convicted, knowing that once they are convicted, it's so close to impossible to undo that is gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
The only other thing that I wrote down that I also do not really see in the questions is when Graddick is talking, or when Chris is talking about Graddick saying he's going to suppress the statement, all of this. And it's so, I mean, I want to believe Chris because, and everything he seems to be telling us seems to be true, but it's so like just up in the air of what, no one knows what was really said or done. And it's hard.
Yeah. And I'm going to get, because I've got to go through all those pretrial motions to see, but that didn't surprise me at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a look, because we've had cases we've worked on where attorneys have been like, I'm going to get this thing thrown out in a couple weeks. I'm going to do da 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 da. And they're still in prison years later. Yeah. Right. So, yeah. I mean, it seems like this would be an obvious thing. My guess is probably he filed a motion to suppress it.
Okay.
And it got denied. I would assume if he didn't, I feel like he would, because I haven't been through all those appeals documents and stuff too yet. That's all stuff that we have yet to come. So it's kind of tricky because we're kind of referencing some of it because it's the one place where we have Chris telling a story of what happened.
Right.
But yeah, that would be my assumption is that if they had filed an ineffective assistance to counsel claim, which is where a lot of this transcript comes from, and it was part of the PCR hearing, was that the counsel was ineffective. Like I said, you know, and Graddick just threw him under the bus. Is like, no, I told him he should take the deal. You know, try to get him to.
And I wonder what the deal was. I mean, is there any way to find out what they offered
him? Yeah, it says it in there. And again, we'll cover it later, but just I believe it was something like 80 years.
Okay.
You know, basically they, you know, instead of five life sentences, you know, or 500 year sentences, you know, you can plea down to 80 years or something like that. And that's it. It's a little nuanced because in Chris's own testimony, I think that's probably part of the reason why it wasn't successful. As he said, I was never going to take the deal. Mm-hmm. I told him I wasn't going to take the deal.
That's hard to see that as a deal anyway.
Yeah.
Once you're talking about that.
21-year-old kid, and they're going to tell you we're going to lock you up
right,
for
and
80
years. That's why I was curious as to what the deal actually was.
Yeah. And it was one of those, I'm sure it was one of those, I think it was 80 years. Could be right. Something like, it was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure it was something like, it's 80 years with good time. You'll get out in 40. You'll only be 60 years old. You still have some life to live. Mm-hmm. You know, it was probably something like that.
Right.
But but that's the nuance to it, is part of what had to have played a part in that decision is not only I'm not pleading guilty to something I didn't do, but also, you know, that he's according to Chris, his attorney's telling him with full confidence, oh, the only thing they have is this confession, and I'm getting that thrown out. That's going to be easy to throw out. They didn't give you an attorney, you know, and so my guess is they probably presented that as a motion, said he asked for an attorney, wasn't given one. And then the prosecution probably said, no, he didn't. And they're like, well, prove it.
Yeah.
Denied. I think it was probably that easy. But the frustrating part is Graddick should have known that. If indeed he spoke with confidence that he was going to get this thing thrown out, he should have fucking known better than that. Like, there's no way that was going to get thrown out based on the person saying, the person when they're presenting where they signed off their Miranda warnings and them claiming that they had asked for an attorney, but the Miranda warning comes before the actual statement, there's just no way that's going to get thrown out.
Yeah, it looks tough. It looks bad.
Well, that was something that Nancy had asked in our questions. Is there some similar case law to Brady about excluding testimony if a lawyer is denied after asking for one? But if you can't prove that conversation ever happened.
Yeah, well, and again, to put that the finer point on it, again, it's not just that they can't prove that it didn't happen. They have where Chris signed off the Miranda waiver. Now, we heard that's part of why I wanted you guys to hear the whole story. What Chris said happened is because, you know, he's like, there was hours and hours and hours and hours of him saying, no, I want a lawyer. No, I want a lawyer. And according to him, it was when they made very clear to him that he wasn't getting a lawyer and he wasn't leaving that room until he signed the Miranda waiver, and that they were going to put his girlfriend in prison or in jail if he didn't sign the Miranda waiver. Then he signed it, and then they then use that against him. Like, how can you say you wanted a lawyer? You signed right here and said you didn't.
Yeah. I mean, except for kind of going back to the conversation that you had with Dr. Nikki, which is, I know you guys already covered this, but the same thing holds true. Like, in terms of, like, if you only have a confession, if you have a confession and you don't have the recording of the confession, anything could have happened to get to the person to the point where they're confessing. So it's like you'd think that that it would fall on the side of, like, well, that's, you could be threatened into confessing, or you could be threatened into being, you know, like, not asking for an attorney or whatever. Like, that's why you would have the accountability of knowing that, you know, it's not just unfortunately, we have to live in a more cynical world where you can't just say, well, it's a police officer, therefore everything is going to be taken as truth. Like, done, cool, like, we don't need any proof of anything because the police officer said he said so.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's really hard, us that work in the wrongful conviction space get that. It's so hard to find jurors that get that, and, you know, because I think they do look at it just like that. They look at it like, well, the cop said he said that, and of course this guy who confessed. And then keep in mind, and I don't know if it was we only have a couple questions, I'm already jumping ahead of them, but one of them was kind of asking, or even just kind of making the statement, like, how the hell did he get convicted? I can't believe with what we're hearing, how could he possibly have got convicted? I think the answer to that question is, even though the confession was shaky at best, didn't fit any of the evidence, didn't make any sense, there's all these other issues that go along with it, which the jury didn't hear because Chris didn't testify. But then you had Larry. You've had, you know, Larry's testimony was the linchpin of the case, because you might get him past the confession, but you're not getting him past a confession coupled with Larry Brooks coming in saying it was Chris Bynum that did it.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Yeah, that was Olivia and Kristen were both just kind of in that space of, like, how. Yeah, and Colin asked too, as we are talking about these conflicting statements and other things, everyone's sort of were grasping for, like, what else could his attorney have done, brought to the table, so that some attention could have been brought to this. Colin says, might be getting a bit ahead here, but did the prosecutor present Chris's second statement as what they believed happened with Amp being involved in the ballpark shooting, or change the narrative completely and just use Chris's statement to show his involvement? So if you're in a position where you do have someone saying things that don't line up and things that don't add up, do you get to just like pick and choose and sort of create the story that best serves you?
They do, kind of, with their opening and closing statements, which the phase we're moving into now is actually going through like the trial transcripts, how the case was presented to the jury. So I don't want to get too far ahead of that, but kind of the state is able to, in their opening and closing statements that aren't evidence, they're able to be like, listen, he admitted he was there. He admitted he shot three of them. He admitted he had the gun. Of course, he's going to try to lessen his involvement in things and put it on somebody else. But we know he was there. Larry Brooks told you he was there. He told you he was there. He told you he fired the gun. And so the whole trial, as we go through the transcripts, it's very ambiguous. Like the state is like purposefully very ambiguous. You know, I've mentioned in some of the transcripts we went through already how they avoid really digging into details. And then if you circle that back to, you know, what could Craddock have done? You know, when I'm reading the transcripts, it's like, why don't you pin down how, you know, the actual facts of the case? And I don't think he knew them. I really don't. I really don't think he knew the specifics, you know, as far as the crime scene reconstruction and how things happen. Like, but again, there's always this, I was going to say that, you know, like say, well, you have this witness that said Amp never left the house, the one witness, and that he heard two guys in there, you know, committing this crime. And then you're putting this guy up on a confession that says that Amp left the house and went and did this. Then they can just spin that to be like, well, yeah, he's just trying to lessen his involvement. So there was just all kinds of throughout this investigation and throughout the trial, just sleight of hand. Like they don't, you'll hear when we get into the opening and closing arguments that, you know, they did come up with a narrative of what happened, but even that's a bit ambiguous because they just didn't need to get specifics. They had a confession of sorts, and they had Larry Brooks saying the words Chris Bynum, you know, 10 times while he's on the stand.
Yeah.
It was pretty insurmountable feat. My biggest complaint is when you had Larry Brooks on the stand, that's when you should have been pinning him down with case details, which is hard. We talked about that when we were in that episode. It's a 12-year-old kid. You could, number one, it's hard on the kid. Two, you could really turn the jury against you by pushing a small child like that. But it's like, man, you got a guy's life on the line. You got to, you know, as gently and as kindly as you can, somehow get the facts in that show that that testimony was not accurate.
Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Yeah, and you know, just thinking too about the sort of situation of any given jury. I mean, obviously, I don't know, but do you think it's possible that in certain communities or certain cities that are known to have violent crime and stuff like that, do you feel like it's possible that having a jury of your peers might also mean that you are bringing in potentially a group of people who's like also sort of exhausted by the system in some way, or exhausted at the idea of, or has been told by authorities and the news and the media, and like however information is getting to people, this idea of like, well, you know, this is just like a town full of thugs, like people be killing each other, like that you come in and that you have the whole voir dire period where you're supposed to be sort of weeding that out. But if the entire culture of a city is part of it is their reputation and kind of the fatigue of just being like, oh, another murder. Like, we got a guy who says he did it. Cool. Like, let's button this up. Like, that there would be that sort of feeling from even the jury, possibly. I mean, it's all that, wildly speculative because I don't know anything about the jury, but.
But I think it's possible. Yeah. And we look at the people in the community during season 15. I spoke to, you know, that are living in the community in Benton Harbor and how that like violence has just become a part of their life. And, you know, I could certainly see a situation where I don't want to say apathy, but some kind of apathy where it's like, it's just another murder. It's another thug. He's, you know, Chris is presented to the trial, to the jury, even though that's not at all what he was presented to the jury as. He's just another thug. It was a drug deal, even though, you know, there's no evidence that he did drugs or sold drugs. They just spin whatever yarn they want to. And it's just like more of the same.
Yeah. Kathy says, I find it odd that Shanita didn't know which arms Chris has his tattoos on. And then, is there any chance to get his conviction overturned by the ineffective assistance of counsel or violating his right to an attorney, which, of course, we talked about. And we talked about the Miranda waiver. But the not knowing which arms Chris had his tattoos on. Yeah, I guess I didn't really notice that. But
And that's kind of what I was getting at with how this thing is made to look like a transcript.
Yeah.
Right. Like, because like I feel like you would have been like in a real interview, you'd been able to pin that down. I mean, first of all, I could see, like, I'm thinking right now, you know, Becky's got a big tattoo on her shoulder, mm-hmm. the book tattoo that Kyle did. And I can't think of which arm it's on now that I'm sitting here thinking about it. But if I thought it through long enough, I probably could.
It's definitely not as easy as you think.
Yeah.
You know, and it's highly suggestible.
Mm-hmm.
It's highly suggestible because somebody can go, what arm is that on? And point. So I will tell you right now, Becky's tattoo is on her left arm.
I bet you know how she was sitting when she was getting it. Yep.
But I know that because I witnessed it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you had to think about it. And if I, for some reason, point, I'm like, what arm was it on? And I just suggest that it's on this arm. Now now you have to think about it.
Yeah. For those that aren't watching this live, Zach just kind of tapped his shoulder while he said it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that's as easy as it could have been. It's like, oh, he's got a tattoo on it. Which arm is it on?
And yeah. Now and put yourself in a situation where your partner is being detained for murdering five people potentially, and
the stress.
The stress of that. Like I would second guess just about anything. Like, what color are his eyes? I'd be like, oh God, what's the right answer? What can I do? Because you're spinning out. Also, there's always, no matter what question you're supposed to be answering, there's always like five things talking to you in your mind, like, oh my God, what if I say the wrong thing? Oh my God, how is this even happening? Is this even possible? How do I get out? You know, so you're not even like, you can't give it 100% of your attention and your memory, right? Because you're going crazy, you know?
And it's so funny, is like, we're having the conversation, I'm trying to think of where Becky's tattoos are. Then I remembered, I have a tattoo that's on my chest that kind of goes up the side of my neck. And I constantly had to be like, is it on the it's on the left, but I forget what side it's on my, mm-hmm. on my chest.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So at first I thought, yeah, that is weird. It's weird the way the transcript's written. But as we talk about it, I'm like, actually, it's not that weird because, yeah, I'm just taking your word for it that Becky's tattoo's on her left shoulder, but I really don't know.
And I may be wrong, but I remember it being on her left shoulder. But that's how easy it is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how this is way off, but I literally had a tattooer ask me how the tattoo healed that he did on me and pointed to the wrong leg.
Yeah.
And I rolled that pant leg up.
Because you forgot where it's at.
Because I forgot where it's at.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh, shit, not even there. And it's on my body.
Yeah.
So,
So I don't think it's as strange as we think. Based on like what Jan is talking about, the stress of it, and just in general, like you think, like obviously you see it every day, but do you really think about, is it right or left?
Mm-hmm.
Especially because if you listen to it, Chris had several tattoos, and I think that makes it even more difficult. Because it's not like he's got one tattoo on his arm and you know it's on the one arm.
But also it's like when you think about looking at someone else, like it's confusing for you because when you see it, often you're looking into a mirror. So that already like flips something in a weird way because you're looking at it on your right, but really that means it's on your left. And it's kind of the same looking at another human being, like knowing that, like I just had that situation where I was watching something. I was watching a show where, as tends to happen on many shows, this is kind of a segue, I mean, a kind of a wild side trip, but we don't have that many questions, where someone was drugging someone's drink, right, in this scene. And because of the way she was standing, when she like drugged the drink, she drugged the drink and then she picked up the glasses and walked across the room, I had to like watch it twice to make sure that the hand that I thought that she used to hand off to the person was the same hand. And it was only because she turned around. Like, that was enough to make me go like, wait. Which glass is it in? You know? So even that is sort of like the way you like experience spatial stuff when you're supposed to really pay attention to something. It can kind of mess with your mind a little bit.
And this is what you get, guys, when you only put six questions is for the follow-up. Is we spend 10 minutes talking about what's...
I do have something
else.
What
side of tattoos
we do have something else. Sharla says, do we know anything about the probation violation Chris was supposedly arrested for on February 18th? Or was it probably just a way to hold him in custody?
You know, I saw that question coming because I had looked for this earlier and kind of gave up because I don't see any reports about it. I just saw that it says that he had, in the report, it says that they had a warrant for him for something else, right? And then it's mentioned, but I can't find the warrant. I even texted Dr. Jackson today and I was like, do you know? And she's like, I don't. And she's like, I don't think there was a probation violation. I don't know what it was. So like, I wish I had the, and these should be easy questions to answer, but we have what's supposed to be a version of the full case file, but then there also, as you heard Dr. Jackson say, when she was on, when they tried to FOIA more stuff, they said, oh, there was a fire and that evidence is gone. So they only had, you know, maybe what was copied to the prosecutor's office or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. But I thought today is like, I needed to go do like a full background check and see if I can find like criminal. Because he mentioned that he had a previous from, I think he said 1997, that he was selling drugs back then for someone. That's about 4 years before this. So maybe it was because of that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that. So we know we have that on his record, but he doesn't mention anything else being on his record. So yeah, I'm not real sure.
Hmm.
So, since we're talking about arrests, and this episode talks about Terrell's arrest, what do we know? All we know is that he was arrested that night.
And then he wasn't. That's all we know. Yeah.
Does it say what he was arrested for?
Well, he was arrested for the homicide. Like, he was arrested for PC homicide, which means a probable cause for the homicide. So he was picked up for that. We have no statement from him. You know, it's by looking at the documents we have, it's like, did he just say, nope, I'm not talking, I want a lawyer, and left, and that was it?
Mm-hmm.
Or was there a statement? And you just can't trust anything out of this police department. All we know is he was arrested and then he wasn't. Like, there's not even a document that I found that shows like when he was released.
That is wild.
Yeah. And then I thought, well, they must have arrested him because of Chris's statement. But then if you were paying attention, the timing of it, Chris started his statement, I'm working off memory here, but I want to say at like 9:11 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And Terrell was arrested at 9:30 p.m. So like he hadn't even gotten to the point yet of saying, literally, like timing wise with the timestamps on the pages, when Chris says that Terrell was, you know, he walked in and Terrell was clicking the empty gun, Like, he hadn't even said that yet. When they're, so I don't, like, did they arrest him because of a tip or from like, I have no idea. It's the weirdest thing. Like, he comes in, he gets arrested, then we hear it, then we get Shaky gives a statement, and then Shaky's arrested, and then Shaky's, you know, put in a yard with Chris, and then he's released. No idea what happened with Terrell. And, you know, you can see a release, same way Shaky was, when Chris gives this new statement where he confesses to everything and those guys weren't involved anymore. But, like, why was he arrested to begin with? I don't know.
Yeah, it almost has to be from that tip, because I don't know how else you'd get to him.
Well, and get all it says in the police report is that he was arrested due to probable cause for murder. Doesn't say why, doesn't say anything about a tip. That tip doesn't exist anywhere in any documentation.
Yeah, that one's a mystery. And of course, then once you've, and I know that we talk a lot about trying to retain perspective and, like, remembering that there are lots of people who are arrested who absolutely should be, who should be not be on the streets, of course. But then when you hear stuff like this, once you have the accumulation of all of these different cases where all of these different things happened, it's hard not to kind of, because we're these creatures who learn from what we know already. You know, it's like, was he a CI? Like, you sort of run through the Rolodex. That's a very old term. I didn't even see, I don't think I've ever seen a Rolodex, but it, somehow it's maintained itself in the lexicon, where you're like flipping through, like, well, in other wrongful convictions cases, like, why do they, like, bring somebody in and then mysteriously let them go with almost no paperwork? And, you know, sort of, you, it's very easy for your mind to go, well, what does this remind me of? Or where, you know, where have I seen this before? Or have I seen this before?
Well, and like, if you imagine that everything Chris said is true, then it's like, so what's happening here? Is this, you know, letting Shaky, letting Terrell go, all this stuff, is this just, and not, when we know there was two people there, not arresting a second person, not charging a second person, is this just complete apathy? Like, I don't care who I, or is it something like they're CI, so they're going to protect them? Like, it really seems to me like there was definitely the apathy angle was a huge part of it. I think that very much like Angelique told us, the way that the police in Benton Harbor see that, you know, you remember from season 15, she said, they act like we're not even humans. They treat us like animals. And is it something like that? They're just like, oh, these are, you know, what Tasha told us, that what the detectives said about her mom was like, well, you know what kind of person she was. You know, so it was like, oh, were they just throwaways to them? And that's why there was no real investigation?
Yeah.
Yeah, sadly, I can see that.
The last thing I have is from Simone, and I just saved it for last because I do know that this is something I listened to the follow-up. Of course, I wasn't on the follow-up last week, but I did listen to it. So I know you guys did talk about the difference between and how a police officer can even manipulate the way that you mention an attorney. Or, you know, Simone says, I wonder if he did mention needing attorney versus actually asking, because it is that common loophole. And I know you guys did touch on that last week, the idea of what they will do to you, even if you say, I think I might need an attorney, that I believe you, Bob, said, you know, that they'll use that. They'll be like, wow, you think you need an attorney, huh? Because it'd be so much easier if you just talk to us, you know, listen, you getting an attorney, that's a real bad look. Are you sure you don't want to just come clean now? Because you could just come clean now and da da da, you know, just even that, like, even if you do, yeah, well, and then taking that all the way to the conclusion of, like, even actually doing what you're supposed to do and not getting it.
Yeah, all they got to do is get you talking again after you said you might want an attorney, and now you've kind of invalidated that. And but usually when that comes in is in a recorded interview. So that, and that's the difference here. So in a recorded interview, it's come up, say, with Sandy Melgar. It was a good example of that, where she keeps saying, I think I should get an attorney. I think I should get an attorney. And, you know, they tried to overturn that based on the fact that she was denied, or get it suppressed because she was denied an attorney. And, you know, the ruling was, well, she wasn't clear that she wanted one and she kept talking. So it didn't matter. In this case, it's not recorded. So it doesn't matter if they did that, or if he did that or whatever. And you'd have to, it just comes down to whether you believe Chris or not. You know, as I keep saying, like, we have to remember, there's no way for us to prove this. But as far as Chris says it, he just kept saying no. And I think the timing, in my opinion, the timing sort of validates Chris's version of it.
Yeah.
Because I don't think he would spend 10 hours in the interrogation room nonchalantly saying, maybe I want an attorney, without saying anything until 9 p.m.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or 8 hours or whatever it was. I think that big time gap from the time he was put into the interrogation room until he actually signed the Miranda waiver indicates conflict to me.
Yeah.
To me, there's a conflict there. Like, you don't sit there for 8 hours saying, maybe I do. Well, let's talk a little bit. Nothing. That doesn't happen. I think that it was, in my opinion, it sounds legitimate to me that he would have been the entire time saying, no, I'm not saying anything. I'm not signing that waiver because I want an attorney.
Yeah. Well, again, it goes back to, like, if you're just recording something, then nobody has to get the benefit of the doubt because you have the evidence. So it's not fair. Is it not fair to a police officer when there's no recording of anything and a person says, I asked for an attorney and you can't prove that they never did that? Well, that doesn't sound fair either, does it? Well, that's why you record it.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not good. Whoever's lying, the other person doesn't benefit. The benefit just comes from, like, actual proof, actual evidence.
We wouldn't have to be having this conversation
exactly.
at all had they recorded it.
Exactly.
And with that being said, I think that's a good time for us to go ahead and wrap this thing up. So we want to thank everybody for listening. Don't forget, as of right now, we're off for next week. I'll let you guys know on social media if there's going to be a bonus episode on Sunday. Other than that, for everybody, the next episode will come out next Sunday, the 19th. And in that episode, we're going to, I want to give us the other side of this story. We're going to go through Detective Donald's testimony and what he says happened throughout this entire process. That'll be coming up next Sunday. And for you patrons, look for us on Wednesday evening. We're going to do a pregame stream for the patrons. As I mentioned at the beginning, if you're not a patron, don't worry about it. You're not missing anything to do with the case. That's just our pregame show where we just kind of chat a little bit and talk about our lives and things like that. Just kind of to unplug for a little while. So we'll be doing that for our patrons on Wednesday. We'll be back for everybody else on Sunday. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. Co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.